all of my life. And not more than 3 weeks ago, when my mother came to New York, she said to me over a table in a fancy French restaurant on the East Side, she says, "Jeannie, are you still playing the bazoo?" Well, I said, "Ma, it is not a..." And then I stopped. I stopped right in mid-crepe Suzette, because I knew, for one thing, my mother is far too old to change her ways now. And also, what difference does it make? Why not allow her to say bazoo? Why not give her that little deference, "Ma, yes, I still play the bazoo." And she says, "That's nice." She says, "But I hope you don't disturb people." Well, Ma, I'm not sure that I don't disturb people, but I'm still playing the bazoo, and so please don't call up and say, "Mr. Shepherd, that is not a bazoo, that is a kazoo." To me, it will always be a kazoo to millions of other suffering, struggling, jots and flotsams, little bits of human wreckage. It will always be a bazoo. And so now, for those of you who enjoy good bazoo playing, I will play just a little bazoo here to calm the swelling waters of the storm. It's like pouring a little oil out there, you know, once in a while. Either that or it's pouring a little kerosene. I'm not so sure whether... What is it they used to call? My mother never called it kerosene. By the way, it is coal oil. So I'm pouring a little coal oil on the turbulent waters of the human storm, all right? So one of my favorite tunes, Betty Coed. And I just feel that the good old tunes are the best tunes. Don't you, friends? Eh? What a rotten cliche. But, you know, I'll tell you, if I really wanted to, you know, they talk about folk talent. I don't think a guy playing a guitar is a folk talent. I really don't. I think, a guitar is something you have to learn to play. You have to tune it. You have to buy it from Sears Roebuck. You get it from the pawn shop. Somebody sent me a great card the other day, and he said, "Shepherd, there's a pawn shop down on 10th Street, just off Sullivan." He says, "Down on 10th Street there." He says, "There are 143 guitars hanging from the ceiling there." He stopped and counted them at 2 in the morning. And he said, "These are signs of the times." He says, "Maybe good times are coming." He says, "They're all going back into the pawn shop where they all belong." in fact, in my neighborhood, there was one time when you could walk along the street and you looked in the pawn shop and you could tell just exactly how the economy was going by the number of banjos that hung in the window. They had 87 million banjos, and Uncle Carl's banjo went in and out of a pawn shop on Hoyne Avenue for over 20 years, in and out. Whenever he was really strapped, you know, he'd go down to the Bluebird Tavern there, and he's having trouble. When he was really strapped, he would tag the tenor banjo. He always got $6 for it because he had a great tenor banjo. Well, now, I don't believe a guitar. I really don't. Is a folk instrument. You got to learn to play it. In other words, it's an instrument that is a created instrument. It is no more a folk instrument than, let's say, the harp. I don't know any, you know, I suppose there are some folk harpists around. I don't think the Wurlitzer organ is a folk instrument, although I knew a lady who played one of the folkiest Hammond organs. Of course, there's another phrase, a lot of words you can apply. Funkiest is the word they used to apply. But she used to sit there, and she knocked out the most beautiful... Lovely. She used to knock on endless choruses of Bringing in the Sheaves. Very good. Now, she was a folk instrumentalist. Did I ever tell you about the folk musician I ran into once? I wish I saw this. I'd love to see this guy again. This is in the Army. Now, this is an Army story, but it really isn't an Army story. It's about the story of mankind. A guy struggling against ineffable odds. Now, the odds that most of us struggle against, I think, are no talent. Most of us have absolutely no talent. And so all of our lives, we keep wondering why we never make it. All of our lives, guys keep knocking their heads against the wall, and they keep thinking it's politics. It's always politics in the upper echelon that keeps them from becoming the boss or keeps them from becoming, and actually it's just nothing between the ears. No talent whatsoever. There is not any one given thing that they can do worthy of even sniffing about it. You know, they can't do anything. They can't even walk good. Many human beings don't even learn how to walk. They don't even learn how to eat good. They keep spilling it off the spoon when they eat. You know, they shovel it in and it dribbles down over their elbows and down into their sleeves. And no talent. They even have no talent for life. Have you ever thought, you know, speaking of life, you know, they're discovering that many people, you know, the allergists, you know, allergists are working on dust allergies and all that kind of stuff. Do you know that they have discovered a strain of allergy? They don't even want to talk about it. There are people who are allergic to life. Life makes them break out in hives. Yeah, there's only one cure for it. Shot in the head. That's all. Seriously. So, you know, so we're fighting constantly against no talent. Reviewers, they're standing at the floodgates there. That any minute now, thank God for reviewers. I'm not a reviewer fan. But if there were no reviewers, can you imagine what would happen to us? Every single lout in the country would make a movie. They would. And every single no-talent idiot would sit down and he'd finally send his book off. And, oh, wow. I mean, it would be just incredible. We would be knee-deep in you-know-what before nightfall. It would be flowing down to the sea like the Mississippi. And we would be all drowned in the tremendous tidal wave of crud that would pour out. And it's all there. I'm telling you, it's all there, ready to be tapped. And there hardly anybody will admit that he doesn't have talent. I have never heard anybody in the elevator, Jim, say, well, one thing about me, Fred, the one thing that I've always worried about me, I got no talent. Never. Oh, man. What they always usually say is one thing, of course, I don't have the ability to sell myself like Charlie does. Charlie can sell. Of course, Charlie only sold himself by writing 7 fantastic blockbusters, the great American novels. He wrote 4 movie scripts. I just can't sell myself. I can sell other guys, but I can't sell me. Well, of course, the guys he sells are named Herman Melville. He was able to sell a guy named Dreiser. He also sold a guy named Scott Fitzgerald. He said, but I can't sell me, you know? Well, of course not. He's pure silly putty. He is a drug on the market. How many guys are listening tonight that know doggone well, underneath all of the crud, underneath all the jazz, that you are a drug on the market? That you got plenty of ambition to sell, but there are no takers. That there just is no market for you. There is no market for a bad product. You. Oh, what an awful thought. There are guys out there. Stop! Will you turn that nut off? And the wife is sitting there listening to the radio, and she's roaring because she knows she's married to a bad product. And out in the kitchen, there's this guy drinking the beer and watching a Priscilla Lane movie. Once in a while, he says, will you quit listening to that nut? And there is old no-talent Charlie out there trying to out-yell the world again. Speaking of no-talent Charlie, this is WOR, AM and FM New York. Do you have the little whoopee thing in there for us, James? There you are. Press the button there.
Hello?
Hi, honey.
Who is the ailman?
I've been waiting for your call.
He could be you, a man with a thirst for a manlier crew.
9 o'clock at our spot.
3 out of 4 men. Every time choose the bolder, keener tasting ale.
See you at 9.
Valentine.
There are men and there are ailmen. And for an ailman, there's only one ale. Valentine. Bolder, keener, more to the point. Valentine ale. It could make an ailman out of you. What do you say?
Who is the ailman? He could be you.
A man with a thirst for a manlier
crew. Just keep it up there. I want to join the game. Valentine. Oh, I sing Valentine with my teeth gleaming in the darkness. My eyes shining there like the no-talent lout that I am. Who is the Yale man? Oh, he could be you. I'm going to tell you a terrible secret. I shouldn't tell you this, Jim. Do you know that I got a call the other day from an ad agency, and they wanted me to sing a singing commercial? Yeah, they said, well, of course, there's a lot of guys that can identify with that kind of singing. And I said, what do you mean by that? And they says, well, you know, that's the way a lot of guys sing when they're in the John and that. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? You know, I've heard Eddie Fisher crying out loud. I mean, Eddie Fisher sounds like about 15 air conditioners all opposing one another, going in the wrong direction and singing sharp. And, you know, that he really does. He sounds like, I'll tell you, he sounds like Vaughn Monroe without his Adler elevators. He certainly, you know, racing with the moon. High up in the moonlight clear. Well, I'm pretty good. Well, I mean, if I had an echo chamber and I had a big orchestra and a chorus behind me. Now, come on, don't put me down, fellas. Who is the Yale man? He could be you. Speaking of folk talent. That's terrible. I should be serious, I'll tell you. We're living in parlous times. I keep getting letters from people saying, Shepard, why don't you stop wasting valuable airtime and interview somebody? Interview some other time waster who spent 7.5 years writing on the Red China issue. You know, his book will disappear into the 4th Street used bookstores within 5 minutes after publication. But by George, he's being interviewed by everybody in his brief moment in the sun, you know. I'm sorry, fellas, no matter how many books you write, sex will not go away. I'm sorry, fellas, no matter how many books you write, Red China is not going to fold its tents and quietly steal into the darkness. You hear that? Okay. No matter how many books you write, you're not going to once solve why World War II started. It's too late, fellas. No matter how many books you write, the Civil War is over. Fellas, you understand? No matter how many books you write, Richard the Lionhearted is not going to be revisited. Okay? So let's interview some of the serious people here who spend all of their time writing books on, you know. I think writing most books is roughly akin to doing crossword puzzles. A feckless endeavor. Totally feckless. And that's a great word, by the way. I haven't had a good, oh my. A rotten world this is getting to be. Everything is falling apart. I suddenly look at myself and I see a rotten pear sitting there. An old apple or something. I'll have to go out a little further. You know, speaking of folk talent, one time I'm in the army. I just have to tell the story of the first moment that I ran into true folk talent. Now, I'm a kid, you know, and I come from Hammond, Indiana, where nobody worries about, you know, if you take accordion lessons, you take accordion lessons. That's the end of it. If you take tap dancing lessons, that's called art. If you take steel guitar lessons and learn to play Aloha or Honolulu Nights or something like that, that's what kids did. They all went at the age of 6 to somebody's accordion emporia down at the end of the street, and they took accordion lessons and became part of an accordion band. One of the more frightening things that I've seen in my life was 75 kids in an accordion band all together playing Red Sails in the Sunset on $495 accordions, you know. Oh, what a scary thought that was. They're being paid for by guys working nights in the blast furnace. Now, I'm not sure what they thought they were paying for. Now, that is an interesting question when you stop to think about it. Did they think they were, I guess in the Hammond, Indiana, they thought they were introducing their kid to art. And the kid sitting there with that great big sequin encrusted accordion with his name Jimmy, you know, on the front of it. And he's pumping out "When the Swallows Return to Capistrano." And that's considered art. Of course, that was the crowd, too, who believed that Nelson Eddy was a magnificent opera singer. And, their idea of, of, of what they call classical singing was Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy singing excerpts from The Chocolate Soldier. Hop, the boys are marching, you know, that kind of thing. And that was very serious classical music, and they'd get all dressed up in their Sunday suit to go hear it at the Grant Park Shell, and that was called classical. Well, now, so this is the background that I come from, and I'm in the Army, and I'm about 18 years old. I've just gotten started in this whole mess. And they've given me rifles and shotguns. I've got pistols hanging all over me, you know, and I've become dynamic. One of the scariest things was to suddenly arrive in a camp, and after about 8 weeks on the obstacle course, you know, falling down over cliffs and running under, they had culverts all stretched out in the line with water running through them. You ought to crawl through those on a hot August day for about 8 hours straight. I'll tell you, you begin to see the bottom of civilization after a while. Yeah? And it isn't only water they're running through them. They just got the camp water, you know, all the stuff running through to give you training in what the real thing is. And it's real, you know, you're done and you're slugging along through this stuff and you're packing. All your new equipment is wet and your face is wet and the wind is blowing and the dust is flying into your ears. You come crawling out, another blast of heat, and up you go up the rope ladder, you know, and you're over the top and your pack is hitting you on the back of the head and the helmet is ringing and you're canteen. I still have a permanent groove right down here where my canteen got me. Either they gave me a too small canteen or it was too large. I never figured out. It was always getting me. And your gas mask. I have a flat rib over here with a mask hung. On I'd go, you know, jump into the cliff again, over. Oh, it's, you know. Well, after a while, it's funny. One day, I am standing in the latrine. And yeah, I'm standing there shaving, you know, and they have 85 mirrors and something. And looking out at me is a totally different guy. The kind of guy, just a year before, had I seen this guy in a diner, I would have nudged Flick in the elbow and said, watch that son of a gun, watch him. You know, watch out for that guy. And there I was, square-jawed, angry-looking, arrogant, rotten person. You know, that kind of suntanned look, and I'm standing there shaving this face. And it's me, I'm looking out, you know, and I'm swearing. All of a sudden, I'm one of those guys, every second word was just the single Army, all-purpose, universal solvent. You know, the Army has a single word, a universal solvent that it uses to solve all problems. And don't think for a minute that Ike didn't use it. Ike was in the Army, I know, for 30 years. Don't tell me Ike is a nice old man. I know that Ike must have hollered that same word into the phone. You know, I just hear the line running. He says, what? What? Montgomery said, what? Well, you tell him. Plunk. Bow. I don't think he did. And I know a lot of people are going to say, oh, that's a terrible thing. And I know for an absolute fact that Truman did. Absolute. Well, in fact, I never knew a guy in the Army who didn't. I don't care who it was. One night I came in. I'm going to tell you an absolute story. One night I came into the mess tent, and it was one of those rotten nights. Half the mess tent had flown away. The wind had come in, you know, and everything had blown in. The trees were falling down. You could hear the screams of the guys out in the woods there when their pup tents were taken off into the clouds. I come into the mess tent about 2 o'clock in the morning, and ahead of me is a chaplain. The chaplain says, what do you got to eat? And they had cold oatmeal, and the chaplain used the one single Army solvent word. That's all he said. He laid it right out there. Well, he was in the Army. He was a chaplain. He was in the Army. So he comes out with the blah, blah, blah. And the PFC turns, and he sees it's only a chaplain. You know, it's a captain, but he's only a chaplain. And the PFC goes, blah, 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 blah. And the captain says, blah, 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 blah. And they're hollering back and forth. You see, there's 18 million shadings on this word. See, and with that, the captain sticks out his mess kit. The PFC dips into the oatmeal, the old square oatmeal. You know, it was from yesterday morning. You see, and it had a thin coating of scum. You know, like oatmeal gets on it. He scummed out the oatmeal, plop right there. And the chaplain goes out with his crosses and everything, and he goes off into the darkness. So don't tell me that I didn't. I'm sorry, he must have. Well, I'm, so here's this guy, I'm shaving myself, and I'm looking at that thing in the mirror, And I'm saying these words as these guys keep walking in, you know, I'm hollering, right? Somebody else, oh, come on, Shepard, will you, for crying out loud, how long are you going to use the sink? Eight guys are lined up behind me, I'm shaving. I survived my hour. And I'm there shaving and looking in the mirror. And I am the same guy that had I gone into a diner a year before and seen this lout up there paying, you know, where the donuts are and yelling at the waitress. And I'm the same guy I would have kicked Flick in the ribs. My buddy, and I said, Flick, keep an eye on that son of a gun. Look out. He's going to jump anyway. Watch him. He's going to steal the Ford out in the... Boy, keep an eye on him. There I am, shaving, this thug. Well, all right. So that's what it was, you know. That's what it was. That's what they call indoctrination. There was an... I'll never forget the first moment. I'm not in the Army 8 minutes, and there's a guy standing up. He's got a film going, see? And the film is unreeling. And he stops the film, and of course the film had shown a lot of Germans flying over Rotterdam and all that stuff. He stops the film, and this colonel gets on, and he says, we're all going to turn you guys into blank killers. Well, so I'm sitting down, you know, I'm fresh out of Miss Shields' Sunday school class and all that, you know. I'm sitting down, he says, we're going to turn you guys into blank and kill us. Well, all right. Let's see you do it, Mac. And so we're all scrunching down, and our packs are scrunching up next to our ribs, and we're sitting down there. And by George, here it is, Jim, not more than 8 weeks later, what do you think I am? A blinking killer! I'm there shaving it, this rotten-looking face, a thug. You have no idea, you know, sure, it's a long time ago. It's over 400 years ago. You know, this was the Second Punic War I'm talking about. And it was a long time ago, but it has never gone away. It has never completely succeeded. Once you're turned into a blanking killer, you always remain that. So I'm standing in front of the mirror, see, and I'm shaving this rotten-looking face. It's me, square-jawed, and I've got those little veins, you know, on the cheekbones, and my eyes are kind of bloodshot from running into those great big things with the rope ladders, you know, all day long, yelling and hollering. Because you know what happens when you start using that kind of language continually, like you use in the Army? You get to look like the language. You really do. It forms you. Language forms men, you know. This is an old philosophical thing that the language forms the people. You can't separate them. Well, if you've only got one word in your entire vocabulary, you are formed, boy. So I'd turn around, you know, these guys are, oh, my yawa! I'd holler my favorite word, and they would all holler their favorite word back. Then I'd continue to shave. Every time I cut myself, I holler my favorite word. Every time I reach down to put a little more shaving cream, I holler my favorite word. I turn the water on, out comes cold water, no more hot water, I holler my favorite word. Then the plug is leaking, the water's going out, I holler my favorite word. And then finally when I finish, I wipe my face off, somebody says, come on, get going! I holler my favorite word. I turn around and I go back into the barracks. I start putting my shoes on, I bust my shoelace, guess what? Then I can, so after all, you know, you get to be the same kind of guy. Your language forms you. And it has never left me. Never left me. I am afraid that you never completely expunge the roots of your childhood, which is where I spent my childhood in Camp Crowder. You never completely expunge it from your soul. Never. Now, I can imagine myself lying on one of these leather couches in the psychiatrist's office. You know, I'm lying down there. He says, what are you thinking of? Play her out! He says, yeah, what else? Then I go, bam, bam. See, just a little slightly different reading, see? He says, well, Mr. Shepard, what do you remember of your childhood? He says, well, I really shouldn't, you know, shouldn't tell you the facts of life out there. So now you got the scene, see? All right, you got the scene. It's a one-word vocabulary. Everybody's got it, see? So one day, Shepard is walking along, and he gets nabbed by the duty corporal. I am walking along outside of the day room, and it's one of those sunny days, and everything is, you know, working out pretty good. I got my fatigue hat in the cocky angle that you wear a fatigue hat when you're off fatigue. And, you know, it's one of those wavy things, you know, the brims. I still got it at home. I'll have to wear it down here to the station someday. I've got names written all over it of guys I ran into all over the Army. And it's got, you know what I had on the front of it, Jim? I had, you know, the fatigue hat, see? I guess they call them a crew hat almost like now, but it's just a wavy brim hat. It's not the kind with the bill, the baseball cap type. It's the kind that just, you know, goes all the way around. It's wavy. It's the kind that prisoners wear and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and it's a green one, see? And I had these names written all over in ink that had accrued over the centuries. And in the front of it, at the front of it where it tipped up, I would tip it up once in a while, I had in red ink and in blue ink my call letters. My amateur call letters across the front, see? So whenever I met another ham, they would have their call letters. And I remember one time in the middle of one of the rottenest fatigue duties I ever had in my life, about eight of us guys are up to our knees in the grease pit somewhere, and we're slogging away and digging, and we're covered with crud. We're sent from a casual, 18 different casual companies had sent these guys down into this great black hole of Calcutta to dig it all out. See, and we're down there and we're working away, and I look up, and there in front of me with a shovel digging away is a guy wearing a hat. A guy I knew from the days when I was, you know, I had been on the air, and he was a guy I talked to for hours, and there he is. We're both fighting the war. He's got his call letters. For you hams who want to know what my call was at that time, it's W9QWN, Quebec, Washington, Nevada. And the guy who I met in the grease pit was W9HUK, Huck. And there was Huck, and Huck looks at me, and I look at him. He says, "Ship!" And I said, "Huck!" And then there was a brief pause, and behind us, the sound of the corporal. "Hey, where are you?" He's hollering at us, you know. And I say, we're down now, digging deep, and I say, "Huck, for crying out loud." He says, "Ship!" He says, "Gee, good to meet you." We had talked to each other over the air for like a year, you know, and now all of a sudden we're meeting in the grease pit. And he says, "Are you on 160? I says, "Am I on 160? We're digging away. So you got the scene. So here I am. I put my fatigue hat on, and I'm walking down the company street, and out of the day room comes this rotten duty corporal, this little lout from Nashville. Oh, boy, if I ever run it, I'll bet that guy right now is a member of the White Citizens Council. You know, he's just got that look. And this little red-haired lout comes out of the day room, and he's got this, "Hey, Shepard, you know that rotten, hey, come here. Hey, you, where you going?" And I turn around. He said, "What are you doing? Turn that hat down. Where do you think you are? You think you're in the Navy? Put that hat down where it belongs." And I turn my hat down. They take every opportunity to humiliate the man of style, you know. So I turn my hat down. He said, come here. He says, "I want you to go down." He says, "You go down to the club down there." He says, "They've got plenty of work for guys like you. You go down to the club. You go down to the service club, and you be down there in 5 minutes. Because I'm going to call a lieutenant down and see whether you arrive. You go down and tell him I said you're doing some work. Now get going. Where you at?" He hollered the single word. Well, down the street I go. Oh, crying out loud, you know. Oh, nuts. You know, I'm going down to the supply room, and I'm walking past the supply room. And in the supply room is Gasser. See, Gasser's in there piling up Form 32s, and he's in there piling up shoes and stuff. And Gasser's got the great duty. You know, that's a great thing to be assigned to the supply room. You just sort of stand around and smoke cigars and holler and steal field jackets. You know, they've got it all going in there. And he watches me go past. "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going out of the service club." He says, "Oh, what do you mean, boy? When did I catch you down there?" I said, "Oh, they already caught me down there. I'm going down and empty the butt cans." And he says, "All right." So down the street I go. Now you're hearing about the real army. You see, so I go down the street, and there at the end of the street, down at the end of that long, rutted, rotten-looking hovel of a street. Now, I mean, you talk about depressed areas. Down at the end of the street is the club. Well, now the club, that was purely a euphemism. This was not the New York Athletic Club. I'm sorry. This club was a great big wooden shed, and it had a wavy wooden floor, and every second week, these fat girls from Neosho, Missouri would be brought in trucks to dance with the first sergeants. And the rest of us were allowed to sit around where they had the typewriters that you put the dime in so that you could write a letter home. We were allowed to sit up on the track around the edge and watch them. And the sergeants would dance. So, you know, it wasn't really a real club. It wasn't hard to get in, actually. There were no membership rules. You just had to be completely below the rank of everything to be allowed in there. You come in, and they had an old piano that had been given to somebody. You know, those old things during the war, they were giving away books and stuff. So somebody had a rotten old piano in their basement. They said, let's give it to the Army. Well, the Army got it. And there was this old piano. It hadn't been tuned since the fall of 1908, one of those great big uprights. And I walk into this place. He said, it's absolutely empty. And there is a lieutenant in charge of this hovel. And there's a lieutenant, a couple of guys, and I'm down there now. I've got to go down and submit myself to further indignities. I've got to wash the piano or clean the butt cans or some, all that ridiculous stuff. So I get into this place, and all of a sudden I'm hit. I hear this tremendous sea of sound coming on. It's just rolling up. It's going. It's just roaring. The whole place is filled with the sound. And I look around, you know, and I remember, I come from the Nelson Eddy world. I come from the world where a real serious singer is somebody like Dennis Day. It's a very serious, because he had a high voice. Everybody that had a high voice was considered very serious. A soprano, to my father, was a serious classical singer. She could have been singing in a soprano voice, yes, sir, that's my baby. But it was serious music, and they all loved soprano. So I come into this place, and the sound is rolling out. It's a piano sound. It's just filling the whole place, and it's going like mad, like 18 pianos playing at once. And down at the end of this room, this long gym-like affair, I see this piano in the gloom down there, and I see bobbing up and down behind it, I see another fatigue hat. And what is he playing? He's playing George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. I can't think of the theme of it. How's it go now? Bum 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 bum. He's going like that. He's playing it five times faster than I ever heard it played before, with at least 18,000 more notes than I ever heard before. He's playing the whole piano at once. It's going like mad. The piano's jiggling up and down. I see the hat going up and down like that, and the sweat is flying. I come into the place. And so, you know, I'm fascinated. You can't hear anything in there except the sound of this enormous piano going. Now remember, friends, I'm talking about folk talent. And so I go around the back of the piano, and here it is, it's bouncing up and down, and the windows are rattling, and he's bum 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 bum. And boy, he's really belting it out. Well, I go around the edge of the piano, and there sitting is this guy with a red face. He's one of those guys with a kind of receding chin and protruding teeth. And he's got a kind of a bulging forehead with sort of black, curly, sweaty hair. And he's little. He's about 5'6", something like that. His feet barely hit the keys. Sweaty, rotten, stinky set of fatigues. And he's got his fatigue hat on the top of his head, and he is all over that keyboard simultaneously. I'm telling you, he's going like Barney Google in a high windstorm. He is really belting the daylights out of this thing, and it's an old upright, and the thing is untuned, but he is getting more out of this thing, believe me, than you could get out of a wind-up Victrola at high noon. He is really going. And so I stand there and look at him. And he says, hi! His arms are flying, his feet are going. I said, wow! All I could say was, wow! And he stopped, and it crashed. And the keys are all jiggling and vibrating, and the piano is going, doing, 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 doing. He turns around, he's breathing heavy. And he says, you on duty here? He says, you on fatigue with me? And I said, yeah. I said, let's empty the butt cans. He says, okay. He says, let's go. You start at the front, I'll start at the back. So he goes to the front, he starts emptying the butt cans, and he's emptying like mad. You see, I'm sort of, you know how you do in the Army. You fool around. I'm walking around with one butt, and I'm clean, you know. And he's running around like mad. And I say, hey, come on, take it easy, will you? He said, I want to get back to the piano. I says, all right. So he finishes his half, and he runs around. He's back at the piano again. And this time he starts out, bum, 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 bum. He's playing Beethoven. Fantastic roar of sound. And this is not piano music, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, but it is when he's playing it. So I go up to him and I says, hey, come on. I says, well, where did you learn to play the piano? And he's playing like mad. And he says, I just picked it up. Bum, 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 bum. He says, he just picked it up. I says, you mean I'm hollering over the sound of the scherzo movement? He's playing 4,000 notes. I say, what do you mean you just picked it up? He says, I play by ear. He plays Beethoven's Fifth by ear. Well, let me tell you, I'm staggered back. You know, I said, what do you mean by ear? You know, back home, Mrs. Bruner played by ear. Miss Shields, our second grade teacher, played by ear, and her idea of playing by ear was bum 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 bum. All right, now kiddies, I'll sing. Mary hath a little. That was the idea of playing by ear. And of course, you got to remember, this was also the era when every radio station had on it a 15-minute program that began, wouldn't you like to be able to play the piano? Why, just 7 minutes a day will enable you to play the famous Dave Minor way. Listen to this. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Yes, and in just 2 weeks you will be able to play with both hands. Bum, 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 bum. Remember that? You remember when they had those on the air, Jim? Well, of course, I grew up in the air when the whole idea of everybody was to learn to play the piano or learn to play the accordion or learn how to tap dance or possibly the guitar. And here was a guy who played Beethoven's Fifth and the whole scene by ear. He played it by ear. And blah, 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 blah. Well, I said to him, I said, you know, I says, that's fantastic. I mean, how do you learn to do? He says, well, I just wanted to play the piano. And I sat around and I listened to the records in the radio and I just played it by ear. That's all. That's all he can say. I just play by ear. And so he says, do you have anything else you can play? I thought, you know, maybe just he played two tunes. Well, he says, yes. He says, what would you like to hear? I said, well, of course, you know, my idea of classical music is something like, Beautiful Dreamer, da 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 dee. That's classical music. So I said, well, gee, I don't know anything. He says, well, all right, how about this? He sits down at the piano. All right. He bats the keys a couple of times. Boy, I never saw a guy play with more gusto. He just absolutely, without any inhibitions, no fear, anything, he just hits it. So, all right, let's see now. Let's see. What are we doing? How about... And the next thing I know, he is playing something like An American in Paris or Rhapsody. It's booming out. Fantastic. Oh, he's playing all the notes. And I says, wait a minute. I says, for crying out loud, I says, is that just the piano part? He says, no. He says, I just play it all. And by now, the lieutenant has come in. You know, that's a wild stuff. And all lieutenants, in my experience, they all like to pretend somehow that they have more culture than the EM. You know, they know about things like books and stuff. So here he is. He's playing Rhapsody in Blue. It's George Gershwin. And the lieutenant tells, hey, that's Ravel, isn't it? Hey, that's Ravel. Of course, the lieutenant. And with that, the lieutenant says, hey, fellow, wait a minute. He says, wow. He said, whoo, boy. He says, wow, what a lot of piano. He says, I'm sitting in the office there, and he says, coming in. He says, you're not playing the piano part, are you? Well, the guy looked at him with a funny look on his face. He said, well, yeah, I'm playing the piano. He said, but you're not playing the piano part. He said, you know, there's a piano part on that. He said, but you're not playing the piano part. I said, what do you mean I'm not playing the piano part? It was a revelation. Here's a true folk artist, you know. The guy says, well, you're playing the whole orchestra. He's playing all the notes. He sits there and he listens on the record, you know, and he hears the oboes, the flutes, and he hears the bassoons. He hears everything else going, you know, and to him, that's the tune. Now, there is a true folk talent. And so he's sitting at the piano, and the lieutenant says, well, he says, play that over again. So he says, okay, he goes, 4,000 notes come pouring out of this thing. He is playing the entire orchestra. Well, I'll tell you, this guy was great. I was with him for about 6 months in the Army, and then all of a sudden he got transferred to another outfit, and I went into another one, and he was from Detroit, Michigan. Huh? He's from Detroit, Michigan, and I remember one thing about him. He went to Wayne University, which is like a city college in Detroit, and he was always very, very defensive about it. Somebody would say, "Where'd you go to school?" He'd say, "Well, Wayne," that kind of thing. See? And then he would follow it with the single, all-purpose, universal army solvent word. Before somebody else would say it. and we were always talking about Hamtramck. Do any of you know anything about Hamtramck, which is a little city within a city? It's a city completely within the city limits of another city. It's Hamtramck. It's a little island right in the middle of Detroit. It's an island of fist-fighting tough guys, and it's right in the middle of Detroit. It's as if suddenly Manhattan decided it's going to be a separate city. Separate city. It's going to call itself East Charlie. And all the rest of it is New York. I mean, Queens, Brooklyn, we're East Charlie. That's it. We call ourselves Robert Mosesville or something, you know, right here in the middle. And so he was always talking about being from Hamtramck. He would never admit that he was from Detroit because, you see, that was kind of an admission of defeat on the part of a Hamtramck man to say he's from Detroit. And so once in a while, we're sitting in the middle of the mess hall, see, and somebody would say, "Hey, why don't you play Haydn's 102nd for us with all variations, huh? Why don't you?" He'd sit there and he'd laugh. I guess the only time that he realized, you know, a true folk artist, he came out of Hamtramck, and that was the first time he realized that he shouldn't be playing the piano that good. He was playing too much. He was playing it too wide, too big, too tall. And probably today now, he's taking little simple piano lessons. He's starting all over again, and he's probably very rotten. He's playing little things like dong, dong, doing, 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 doing. And he can't even remember being this great folk artist. All right, friends, stand aside. Shepard is going to play a last chorus on his bazoo.